we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both formerly with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. A very busy week in the world. Outside me.
Okay.
But you're not moving very much, but the world around you is moving so fast.
Spinning. Yes. All right, let's begin with...
I may look lazy, but at cellular level, I'm very busy.
I see what happens when we legalize marijuana.
Yeah. It hasn't affected too much in my world.
No, Mike is still at Hempfest.
That's right. So, military equipment.
Yeah, there was some information that came out this week about the military equipment that Washington State Police have obtained through the Pentagon's 1033 program, which supplies military equipment to police agencies all around the U.S., surplus military equipment. Washington police agencies have acquired about $24 million in equipment from that program, which includes everything from assault rifles on up to MRAPs, these big military reconnaissance vehicles that you see in the pictures of the Ferguson, the response to the Ferguson protests. Nationally, the program has put about $450 million of weapons in the hands of local PDs and is set to put about another $500 million worth of weapons into their hands again this year. King County has received about $8.2 million of that, although there aren't any details as far as I could see. In the database that I was looking at, there weren't any details about which police departments got what. But I know that King County received two helicopters, for example, and I'm willing to bet that those two helicopters either went to the SPD or they went to King County Sheriff's Office. And so that's something that I think we should be alarmed about, particularly since that database included a huge number of assault weapons going to King County Police Departments.
And 17 MRAPs for Washington State.
Yeah, mm-hmm. because you can never have enough in a urban war zone like Seattle.
You can never have enough these vehicles that are resistant to improvised explosive devices.
Yes, which especially in Ballard is a huge problem, you may have noticed. Oh, wait, those are the potholes.
Those are potholes, yes.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. More developments this week in the Seattle Police Department and Department of Justice agreement.
Yeah, this week the SPD went to the judge that's overseeing the DOJ agreement with the Seattle Police Department and asked for an extension of time to implement a computer system to track use of force incidents. Judge Robart, who is the judge who's overseeing the implementation of the Department of Justice agreement with the Seattle Police Department, he granted the 9-month delay until March 1st, 2015. But he was upset that the police department hadn't even started getting this computer system implemented.
You're
Monitor
kidding.
Merrick, yeah, no kidding. Monitor Merrick Bob said the delay was due to resistance within the SPD to implementing the settlement agreement during its first year of the program. Now, that would be pretty much all of 2013. Judge Robart then scolded the SPD and said he was also concerned by the new Chief O'Toole's decision to redeploy bicycle officer Randy Jokola to street patrol after he was briefly sidelined for writing about 80% of the tickets related to marijuana possession and use in public.
Incidentally, I was talking with somebody who hangs out down that area a lot who says, you know, pretty much all the people in downtown on 3rd know exactly who that guy is and avoid him like the plague. He's notorious.
Yeah, and Jokola, when he wrote those tickets, he wrote on the back of the tickets, he wrote comments to address to Attorney General Pete Holmes, who is a supporter of the legalization of recreational marijuana. And Robart referred to that as possible insubordination. He was surprised that that officer was put back on the street so soon. And he said that the SPD really needs to get together some kind of uniform disciplinary standards and start and start putting them into practice as well.
Yeah. Well, they do have uniform disciplinary standards.
Unstated uniform disciplinary
exactly.
standards.
And, you know, it's not surprising that they haven't been able to get an Excel spreadsheet, or maybe actually Salesforce would be more appropriate for use of force reports. But how hard is it in the city of Seattle to find somebody who can design a database? I mean, you can throw a rock outside the any precinct house, and whoever you randomly hit on the side, and they like throwing rocks at, although they prefer automatic weapons, but they could throw a rock at somebody, and they'd hit somebody who could do it for them. It's not that hard.
Uh-huh.
It's not that hard to do.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right. Moving on. Microsoft.
Yeah. Speaking of software, Microsoft sent out a press release and had an announcement on Tuesday that may be the first time in the history of Microsoft, certainly in the history of the Seattle Times post-invention of the microchip, that something that Microsoft has done didn't make the front page. And that was Microsoft's announcement that it is withdrawing its support. It's a long time support from the American Legislative Exchange Council. Now, ALEC, as it's colloquially known, is pretty notorious in activist circles. It is a conservative organization that works at the state level and helps businesses feed into state legislatures various anti-regulatory and social conservatism state laws. The Stand Your Ground laws came out of this. The voter ID laws came out of it. A number of different conservative pipe dream proposals have come out of ALEC over the years and implemented very widely across the country.
And ALEC helps to actually write the legislation as well as promoting it.
Yes. Now, reportedly, the reason for Microsoft's quitting ALEC was due to its lobbying efforts to block development of renewable energy, which this was part of a larger Microsoft effort to try and become more energy efficient, which it makes good business sense for a lot of businesses, as well as any PR benefit that they might get out of it.
Well, but, and also I'm sure they're looking at in terms of recruiting good folks to work at Microsoft, too, that if you're going to be a great place to work, people want to know that you're not destroying the planet.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that's partly why they do it, too, is because it helps them with their recruiting.
Yeah. I don't know how many Indian software engineers that's important to. But
well, not all software engineers are from India. And it is probably more important to them than you think, because we send a lot of our tech, especially a lot of our tech waste, over to places like India.
This is true. Anyway, this is something that Amazon had done a couple of years ago. Bill Gates personally and through the Gates Foundation had withdrawn support a couple of years ago. But this is something that Microsoft has been pushed to do for a number of years and finally did it this week. So belated congratulations to them. And it is very curious, though, how the very conservative Seattle Times, to pick one notorious example, didn't particularly feel like this was something worth splashing across the front page.
And that's pretty amazing, because the Seattle Times tends to just print verbatim Microsoft press releases, usually on the front page above the fold.
All right, moving on. The Northeast Cascades getting some heavy rainfall.
Yeah, some pretty heavy rains this the end of this week. On Thursday night, dumped about 1 inch of water in 1 hour on the northeastern part of the Cascades. Now, the problem with that is that that's the region that just recently saw the largest series of wildfires in the state's history. The Carlton Complex, which burned about 400 square miles in that part of the state. And in those heavy rains right after the wildfire, which burned not only trees, but also burned all the underbrush, pretty much everything that would hold those steep hillsides together, that super heavy rain in such a short time meant multiple massive mudslides that have wiped out homes, businesses, and two highways, Highway 20 and Highway 135. And I just want to point out that this is what scientists mean when they say that we're seeing the effects of global warming now, today. Because really, if you think about this year here in the state of Washington, we had a really wetter than usual spring. followed by about 6 weeks of super dry weather. And what that did was that wet spring meant a huge overgrowth of underbrush and greenery all around the state. And then you follow that with 6 months of dry weather where you don't get hardly a drop of rain. And what does that do? That dries up all that new growth and turns it into the perfect fuel for wildfires. Those wildfires sweep through, and then all of a sudden you come back with more rain. But this time it's not our typical drizzle. It's heavy, heavy soaking rains again, like you usually only see in the tropics. When you get that after a wildfire, you get mudslides like crazy.
Yeah.
So this is just something that we need to keep in mind is going to continue to happen.
And you also see heavier rains when you have higher than usual temperatures and the air holds more moisture.
Yeah, that's true too. A mean global increase in temperature means that you're going to have a lot more moisture in the air, and that creates these heavy rains. That's something that was predicted long ago by climate scientists who were looking at the effects of global warming. So really, you know, this is just another indication of, yes, we do need to be talking today to our members of Congress and putting the pressure on them to make changes, institute a carbon tax, do something in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Yes, and particularly locally, Dave Reichert, who's a member of Congress and is part of a party that denies that global warming even exists.
Yeah, and really it's not going to change until politicians within the Republican Party start to say, look, we gotta change our attitudes here.
Well, there was a change this week in Oregon.
Yeah, there are three coal terminal proposals remaining in the Pacific Northwest, two of them in Washington State in Bellingham and Longview, and one just in the Columbia Gorge on the Oregon side in Boardman, Oregon. Just south of the Hanford complex. The Boardman proposal was killed this week by the Oregon State Department of State Lands. Through an appeal by the Yakima Nation, which is primarily based in Washington State, the Yakima Nation has been fighting all three of these coal terminal proposals. And in the case of the Boardman one, made the argument this is part of their traditional fishing grounds and that it would be irrevocably damaged and a violation of their treaty rights to put this coal terminal proposal into place. And the state of Oregon agreed with them, saying that, quote, the agency record demonstrates that the project would unreasonably interfere with a small but important and longstanding fishery in the state's waters of the project site. Now, Jode Godey, who's the chairman of the Yakima tribe currently, quoted also saying this is only the beginning of what I expect will be a long fight. The Yakima Nation will not rest until the entire regional threat posed by the coal industry to our ancestral lands and waters is eradicated. And you wish that local governments, local governments in the rest of the state would take that kind of attitude as well, that they simply seem to have a different set of priorities from the tribes in this and many other environmental cases.
All right. Moving on to national and a report in The Guardian this week with Homeland Security.
I had to go to a British newspaper, The Guardian, to find a report on the Homeland Security Department's, the United States Homeland Security Department grant program to police departments. Now, most of the U.S. media coverage has been around the Pentagon's surplus military police program, the 10-33 program, but really that's just a drop in the bucket. The Homeland Security Department issues grants that are about three times more money each year to police departments to purchase whatever they want. Current year grants from Homeland Security Department will total about $1.6 billion. That really dwarfs the DOD's program. If you look at only one of those programs, the Urban Areas Security Initiative, it's given out about $7.1 billion in the past 9 years to police departments. Most of this money comes no strings attached. There's no obligation for these local police departments to spend the money on counterterrorism or even for disaster preparedness, even though that tends to be the rationale for these Homeland Security Security Department money when they get it from Congress in the budget. It's to provide this money for you know, disaster preparedness and counterterrorism and stuff.
And we saw that locally with, for example, the waterfront cameras and some of the other things mm-hmm. that have been controversial in the drone program, where those were supposedly counterterrorism projects, but they were not in fact used for that at all.
Right. And you know, there's no accountability. The Department of Homeland Security doesn't collect any data on how the funds are spent, for example. A 2012 audit shows that FEMA, which is the agency that tends to hand out the grant money for the Department of Homeland Security, quote unquote, lacks a clear understanding of its own system, end quote, which has doled out at least $11 billion between 2003 and 2011. Now, really, I mean, think about this for a second. A lot of other federal agencies, when they give out money, take, for example, the welfare program, they require some kind of, they require the recipients to jump through some kind of hoops, you know, to receive welfare funds. You have to prove you don't have a job. You have to prove that your income is low and you don't have a lot of savings. Sometimes in some states, you have to pee in a cup before they give you your welfare money.
And this is for money that is really inconsequential compared to the amount of money that's going into these kind of programs.
Yeah. And you know, here you have police departments. They don't have to prove anything. They just have to go to their state agency and say, hey, can you apply for X amount of money for us, you know, through this Department of Homeland Security program, and the states say, oh, sure, no problem. And then FEMA just apparently just doles it out without a clear understanding of their own program, you know, and then no records are kept, apparently.
And from the other side, what's driving this from the federal standpoint and what's been driving the military budget for a number of years has been the manufacturers of these different weapons uh-huh. and these different programs. And this is one reason why the U.S. is in a state of permanent war, is because there's always, always a push for the newest to purchase the newest generation of these types of weapons. And what the manufacturers are trying to do here is to develop a domestic market for these weapons as well, by essentially, you know, the same way drug pushers do it. They hand out the first ones for free, and then the departments decide that, you know, they really like confronting protesters with the latest in third world urban warfare equipment, and let's do this some more,
and let's apply for some taxpayer money.
Unlike the countries of the world, and there's, let's face it, you can only bomb a dozen or so of them at a time. There are literally tens of thousands of different law enforcement agencies and departments across the country at the federal, state, county, and local level, city and local level. So there's a lot of potential there. And if you've seen there's a map floating around on the internet and on Facebook of the different counties in the U.S. that have received money just from this DHS program. And it covers almost all of the populated counties in the United States.
There are very few that have not lined up for the free money to get the fun military weapons.
Of the 3,040 or whatever it is counties mm-hmm. in the United States, you know, probably 2,800 of them, including all of the populated ones, have received some form of mm-hmm. support from this.
All right. Moving on. Developments this week in Ferguson.
Yeah, around the Michael Brown shooting. It's pretty much been the one thing that has dominated the news. This week in particular, the private autopsy conducted by a New York medical examiner hired by Brown's family showed that Brown sustained 6 gunshot wounds, consistent with some witnesses' accounts that he was trying to surrender and probably had his hands up when he was shot. The response of what is really, I found interesting, is that media has presented this evidence, but then has been careful to say, well, you know, the medical examiner couldn't draw any conclusions about what actually happened because the medical examiner wasn't given any other evidence to look at, like his like Brown's clothing or anything like that. But you know, we do have the witness statements, and the witness statements all say that the officer was nowhere near Brown when he shot him. So
yeah,
I think that's pretty well established fact.
The autopsy came to the conclusion he was probably shot from about 35 feet away. way. That is consistent with the witness statements. Some of the witnesses said that he was shot in the back. Others have said that he turned to face the shooter and had his hands up in the air when he was shot. He was shot from the front, not the back. So mm-hmm. he wasn't shot while he was fleeing. He had turned around at that point. But he was shot multiple times. One of the shots in particular to the head was what killed him.
And six shots is overkill. And that was something that the medical examiner said. He was a medical examiner with a lot of experience. I think something like 40 years of experience doing this work. He'd worked for the New York Police Department. And he said, you know, if I was doing this autopsy for the New York Police Department, I would have to conclude that shooting the guy six times was overkill, that there was no need for that. And that is something that wasn't played up a whole lot in the media. Now, also, what concerns me, too, is the response of the local mayor and the state governor have had to the protests. They've been all over the map, back and forth between, you know, a militarized response from the local police department, and then they bring in the state patrol to do, you know, a brief couple days of community policing, you know. Then it's like, well, that's not strong enough, so we'll deploy the National Guard. Now the governor's withdrawing the National Guard.
And do police raids on the community center that's been set up as a safe zone for local residents who are afraid of the police
for
good reason.
And then all at the same time releasing misinformation about the victim, trying to smear the victim and make him look like he was a criminal, even though that really he really had not done anything wrong on that day, and the officer who stopped him was not aware that he had done anything wrong prior to, you know, crossing the street in a housing development,
and that would not have been an excuse in any event for shooting him point blank like that.
Exactly.
Not point blank, but, you know, so, without provocation, apparently.
So really, it's all really clear to me, you know, and at the same time, the mayor and the governor are all saying, we don't know what we can do to fix this. How do we get people to go home? Well, I have some suggestions for them, some really, really obvious suggestions for them, the things that they could do to solve the problem of the protests in Ferguson. Number one is tell the truth about what happened and do it in a timely manner, which is something that the Ferguson Police Department obviously has problems with. Number two is to meaningfully discipline the officer, not just send him home on paid vacation, which is what they've done. Number three is submit to an FBI review of the local police department. Not to just say, oh, we don't want to do what we did here in Seattle, what our police department did here in Seattle, which is resist and resist and resist and say we don't have a problem, we don't have a problem, when clearly they do have a problem. And finally, to admit that yes, the department does have these problems, therefore we're going to take some meaningful steps to fix them, being training on the use of force, tracking use of force incidents.
There was no apparent incident report filed
exactly.
by Ferguson Police, which is just a lethal use of force incident is mind-boggling.
Is astounding, yes. And then admit, too, that they don't have enough African-American officers and need to hire and train some.
And, there's one thing, and this would be in the hands of the local prosecuting attorney, not the police force, that could be done very simply, which is to indict the officer. Because, again, that's not that's not a matter of convicting him. That's just a matter of saying that you have probable cause to believe that a crime has occurred. He would almost certainly, given how courts treat indicted cops, be let out on recognizance while it's investigating. It would simply guarantee a certain level of investigation, and it would put an instant stop to most of the community protests. But that isn't being seriously considered.
But none
either.
Of these things are being considered. Mm-hmm. And then I just want to talk for a couple of minutes about a New York Times CBS News poll on Ferguson, on the Ferguson protests and the police response. Black and white Americans were sharply divided on some aspects of the Ferguson events. For example, 38% of blacks think the protesters' reactions have been about right versus only 15% of whites. Black Americans are twice as likely to fault police for violence during the protests. And you can ask why. And the survey tells us because 45% of blacks said that they've personally experienced racial discrimination at the hands of police versus almost none of the white respondents saying the same thing. Now, more importantly for local officials in Ferguson, and in the state of Missouri is that 6 in 10 blacks said that they have little or no confidence that a local investigation will be handled fairly of the Michael Brown shooting, while 6 in 10 whites say exactly the opposite. And that really points up the racial divide in how people understand the way the police departments work in the United States.
Yeah, and there's a similar Pew finding poll. 80 to 18% African Americans say the shooting in Ferguson raised issues about race that merit discussions, and whites said about 47 to 30% said the issue of race is getting more attention than it deserves. Whites were nearly three times as likely as blacks to express at least a fair amount of confidence in the investigation into the shooting. Mm-hmm. Roughly three quarters of blacks had little or no confidence in the investigations at all. So once again, the divide along racial lines in this very clearly pointed up.
Yeah, multiple polls.
All right. That takes us on to international, and with about 4 minutes left, I'll let you choose whether we tackle Ebola or
I would like to just talk for a minute about the Ebola crisis. This week we had two of the top leaders of Doctors Without Borders, the nonprofit group that is handling the bulk of the Ebola crisis, basically come out and say that it's out of control. And they believe, as I believe, too, that it's a scandal. It's an international scandal that the Ebola crisis, the Ebola outbreak has been left to two nonprofit groups to handle almost exclusively on their own. And MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, this week said that the international community, even though they have asked multiple times starting back in March for help from the international community to deal with this epidemic, that the international community has done absolutely zero to help, that getting 50 aid workers from the World Health Organization is a tiny drop in the bucket when you've got at least a million people in one country who are under quarantine because of the Ebola virus, and it has spread to four nations in West Africa, which I should point out is probably the most densely populated region of Africa, where borders really don't have much meeting. People move. Yeah. From country to country there all the time.
And that quarantine is almost impossible to enforce.
Very, very difficult. Very, very difficult at this stage when you've got an outbreak that has sickened thousands of people and more than 1,200 of them have died from it.
All right. And Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, this week, President Obama getting a lot of pressure from the Department of Defense, particularly Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, to get engaged in the Syrian conflict. Hagel stood before Congress and said, Hagel stood up and said before reporters that ISIS, the group that controls a large portion of Syria and most of northern Iraq now, and all of Anbar province is the best funded and most dangerous terrorist organization that the world has ever seen. Well, there's no disputing that ISIS is well funded and that they're efficient and well organized. What is in dispute is whether or not they're a terrorist organization. I don't believe so. I think they're actually at this point a national army that is trying to expand its borders.
Yeah, it's an established national state at this point that has a territorial integrity, is trying to expand its borders. They're not terrorists. They are a dreadful, dreadful organization by almost any standards.
Yes.
I mean, you know, really kind of comparable in the scale of what they're trying to do to the Khmer Rouge from four decades ago. But they're not terrorists. Terrorism is simply a buzzword that's used by American politicians and American media to mean people that we don't like. The word has really lost a lot of its meaning. And the other thing that's not discussed about that is where it came from, because ISIS would not exist were it not for the original incursion into Iraq, which Chuck Hagel, as a senator from Nebraska in 2003, did support.
And the Bush administration laid the groundwork for them.
And then the Obama administration's decision to covertly arm rebels in Syria, which funneled a huge number of weapons into the hands of people who are now part of ISIS. We can't talk about that.
No, and of course the Bush administration and then later the Obama administration's support for a Shiite prime minister above all else, which has exacerbated sectarian tendencies in that country, not just the war in Iraq, but also the way we've gone in and established Shiite exiles one after another as the prime minister has really made it very difficult for that nation to stay together.
And the ethnic cleansing that happened in 2006, 2007.
The list goes on, yeah.
Yep.
Events.
Several events. Today, as with last weekend, we have a festival of protest in Westlake Park today at noon, Justice for Palestine and Gaza, with a weekly protest. And then what has become a weekly protest as well, Seattle Stands with Ferguson at 4 o'clock, both of those in Westlake Park, 4th and Pine, yes, mm-hmm. in downtown Seattle. Also today and tomorrow, starting at 10 o'clock each until 5 each day, so you got about an hour to get down there, the Anarchist Book Fair, annual gathering of subversive literature of all kinds, will be happening this year at the Vera Project, which is at Warren and Ferguson, Laura Queen Anne. So go and check that out. Lots of good summertime subversive reading.
And I believe they're doing the Block the Boat in Tacoma as we speak. So.
Oh, yes, that's going on this weekend as well.